Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 462, titled Fifth Column, Part 3, The Subversion of Operation Green Quest. This is being recorded on May 30th of the year 2004. Before I begin, let me remind you that sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio, more recent programs streaming at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, older programs available for download only, also on Real Audio, at a longer URL linked to both the www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery website and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfire List is one word. Within a week or so of the airing of this program, there will be a detailed, annotated, article-length description of For the Record 462 in the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. Listeners who only use the on-air material are strongly encouraged to take advantage of the written descriptions. Not only do they provide one with hard copy that can be examined at greater length, but in addition, the descriptions often include material that I did not have time to include in the original broadcast, obviously for reasons of limitation of time. So please do take advantage of the written descriptions. They're an invaluable resource. Spitfire stocks the various lectures and programs I've done over the years. You can reach them at P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California. Capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip 95005. Email is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. Be aware that there's now a search function on the Spitfire website to help listeners locate particular subjects, and also the vitally important text, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, by the late heroic Paul Manning, is available for download for free on the Spitfire website, along with a thumbnail bio of Paul Manning and some excerpts from the book. So please take advantage of that. Now, this program, again titled Fifth Column, Part 3, The Subversion of Operation Green Quest, is a supplement to a number of different programs, in particular For the Record program number 405 and 433. What we're going to be doing is developing a line of inquiry that I've been investigating for some time, namely the deliberate subversion of attempts not only at blocking the 9/11 attacks, but also, in particular, of investigating the money trail to the Al-Qaeda and related organizations' coffers. Basically, Operation Green Quest is the code name for the operation aimed at interdicting funding sources for Al-Qaeda and related groups. It has been subverted, and we're going to take a look at that subversion. We're going to take a look in particular at indications that the structural economic relationships between powerful people in the Bush administration and the GOP and some of their counterparts in the power elites of some of the Middle Eastern oil kingdoms, Saudi Arabia in particular, have led that those connections have precipitated the deliberate subversion of Operation Green Quest. In particular, the raids of March 20th, 2002, conducted under Green Quest, led to not only elements that overlap the GOP and the Republican Party, but in particular that overlap at one level the Al-Qaeda and Hamas funding organization, and also the Al-Taqwa group as well. The net effect here is that what we're looking at is quite literally a fifth column within the United States. In the deep background, one finds the underground Reich, but in the more immediate scenarios, I guess one could say, or in the more immediate vistas would be a better term, one finds the structural economic relationships between the petroleum industry, the Bush administration, the Republican Party, and the power elites of the Middle Eastern oil kingdoms. We're going to go into that material. And we're going to take a look also at some interesting questions concerning some of the anomalies with regard to the aerial intercept phenomena on September 11th of 2001. A number of people have taken note of the performance of U.S. fighter aircraft on that date. I tend to think, in fact, not I tend to think, but I do think that a great many people have exaggerated or misunderstood some of the aspects concerning the performance of fighter aircraft and also the FAA on that date. But nonetheless, for reasons, by the way, explained and for the record, 459 and 460, but nonetheless, there are some interesting questions. And one of the things we're going to take a look at concerns the fact that a company called PTEC, which has as one of its primary funding people, one of its primary financial backers, Yassin Qadi, fingered as a backer of Al-Qaeda, and also a fellow named Yaqub Mirza. PTEC, again, a high-tech company in Massachusetts, has produced software for the Air Force, for the Department of Defense, for the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, and for the FBI, among other institutions. And that raises some very interesting questions about the performance of the FAA and also fighter aircraft on September 11th, 2001. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article that was published in the Financial Times of London this past week, specifically on May 25th of 2004. A number of newspapers carried reports of a study that was produced by a British intelligence-related think tank called the International Institute for Strategic Studies. This study has indicated that Al-Qaeda has experienced a resurgence worldwide, in part because of the tremendous value from a recruiting standpoint of the Iraqi incursion, and also due to the fact that insufficient use of troops on the ground in Afghanistan has actually scattered Al-Qaeda abroad, whereas they were more or less concentrated in one particular geographic location. Now they are scattered. But perhaps the most important aspect of this study concerns an item that was omitted from all of the American publications that carry this particular story. Only the Financial Times of London of May 25, 2004, of the papers I've read, carried this particular item. This article is titled, Al-Qaeda May Have 18,000 Operatives. That's by Mark Hubend, H-U-B-A-N-D, and David Buchan, B-U-C-H-A-N, and again from the FT of 5/25/2004. This reads, the Al-Qaeda terrorist network is a, quote, viable and effective, unquote, organization that may be able to call on as many as 18,000 potential operatives worldwide, a UK think tank said on Tuesday. And this next part is the element that was omitted from all of the American articles published on this story. In its annual strategic survey, the International Institute for Strategic Studies says Al-Qaeda's financial network has survived largely intact, and that the war in Iraq has brought new recruits to its ranks. None of the American stories that I saw reported on this particular study mentioned that the Al-Qaeda funding structure has remained intact. We've spoken about that at considerable length on this broadcast, and we're going to go into it at greater length on this program, and specifically the role of this fifth column, composed of various elements, not only the American GOP petroleum industry axis, but also their counterparts in Saudi Arabia, and in the background, underground Reich elements. And in particular, I'm very interested in Karl Rove, whom I suspect is quite literally the pivot man for the underground Reich's position in this administration. But we're not going to be taking a look at Karl Rove directly in this broadcast. What we are going to be looking at are the business relationships, the structural economic relationships that exist between the Bush family, the GOP, and their Saudi counterparts, and how this spawned institutions like the Islamic Institute of Grover Norquist, the Wahhabi Al-Qaeda / Al-Taqwa link to the Republican Party, and the implications of this for not only America's policies vis-a-vis counterterror, but in particular the subversion of Operation Green Quest. There has been an FBI translator who is being actively suppressed by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. This is a woman named Sybil Edmonds, and she had produced a number of warnings that had come from various intelligence assets around the world talking about the impending attacks in the United States, and the volume of warnings that were coming in was absolutely legion. One of the things that Sybil Edmonds noted, and we're not going to focus on that past a point in this particular discussion, but she noted that a number of drug smugglers had maintained that they had apparently, by their own account anyway, brought in some of the operatives used in September 11th. That is not only disturbing in and of itself, because the links between organized crime and international terrorism have proved relatively difficult to penetrate, but also in the book Serpent's Walk, that I've used so many times on this program, the terrorist elements that ultimately wind up laying waste to much of the United States and paving the way for an underground Reich takeover, infiltrate the U.S. through some of the drug smuggling routes. Sybil Edmonds is being muzzled by the FBI, and we're going to talk a little bit about her background, and we're going to talk about her analysis of why she is being muzzled and some of the elements that lie in the background. This article was authored by James Ridgway of The Village Voice. It's from his Mondo Washington column of May 25, 2004. This column is titled, "This Made Ashcroft Gag." Subtitle, "Translator Keeps Blowing 9/11 Whistle on FBI. U.S. Keeps Shutting Her Up." Skipping down, we read of Sybil Edmonds. Edmonds said she had heard the details of the Afghan asset story in an unclassified meeting at the Capitol, but she cannot talk about the specifics because of a Justice Department gag order that classifies as secret what she has to say. Parenthetically, this is a warning from an FBI asset in Afghanistan who warned that there was a major terror attack using aircraft that was scheduled for later that year of course being 2001. Now, note in particular, because this is a key to much of what follows, speaking of Sybil Edmonds, James Ridgway writes, she said, however, that, quote, "There are a lot of activities in the U.S., a lot of money, and these activities involve money laundering, drugs, a support network for terrorism, people in high places, people in the political arena," unquote, of the muzzling of Sybil Edmonds, and we're going to take that up later. Edmonds can't tell what she may know because Attorney General John Ashcroft recently invoked an arcane law to make her statements, quote, classified, unquote, including previously public statements and journalism quoting her on the case. At a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing last week, Republican Chuck Grassley of Iowa summarized the Edmonds case in questioning FBI Director Robert Mueller, quote, "I would also like to, on a second point, figure out why the FBI is going back in time and classifying some pretty basic information that's already in the public sector in regard to classification of information that we have received in Congress from a whistleblower, Sybil Edmonds. We have, for instance, an email sent out by the chairman's office last week saying that the FBI is classifying two-year-old information that the committee got in two previous briefings. Ms. Edmonds worked for the FBI as a translator and was fired after she reported problems. As part of the committee's legitimate oversight, we looked into that. The email I have is right here, and so I'm very alarmed with the after-the-fact classification. On the one hand, I think it's ludicrous because I understand that almost all of this information is in the public domain and has been made very widely available. On the other hand, this classification is very serious because it seems like the FBI would be attempting to put a gag order on Congress," unquote. Grassley added again, quoting, "I don't think this is really about national security. If it were, the FBI would have done this a very long time ago. And in fact, you'd be trying to get information back that's already been given to us about Ms. Edmonds." Well, I would suggest that basically this is part of a larger phenomenon that we're going to examine, in which powerful people are being protected, and that if the structural economic relationships between the Bush administration, the fossil fuels industry, the GOP, and the Saudi power elite, including elements that have been actively funding Al-Qaeda and Hamas, if that became public, it would not only lead to the defenestration of this particular administration, but if these leads were properly pursued, it could lead to the indictment of key elements of the Bush administration for treason. And don't expect that to happen anytime soon. Nonetheless, as I indicated in a number of past broadcasts, I think that what is taking place in the United States right now is analogous to what took place in France prior to and during the early stage of World War II, that there is literally a civil war, which in turn is part of a larger struggle. The civil war basically is between sincerely patriotic and democratic elements, with a small d, and this fifth column that is actively subverting the United States. And again, that civil war, I believe, manifesting itself in the intelligence and law enforcement communities, is in turn part of a larger struggle in which the United States is being actively attacked from without by underground Reich elements using Islamist elements as proxy warriors, and also involving some actual underground Reich operatives. In turn, this attack from without is being accompanied by subversion from within. Numerous broadcasts that I've done have spoken about the subversion of France prior to and during World War II. In particular, For the Record program 372, 412, and 441. What we're going to be looking at for the duration of the broadcast concerns the structural economic relationships between the Bush administration, the fossil fuels industry, their counterparts in Saudi Arabia, who some of whom at least appear to be actively funding Al-Qaeda. And again, from the Financial Times of London of May 25th, in its annual strategic survey, the International Institute for Strategic Studies says Al-Qaeda's financial network has survived largely intact. And quoting from the Village Voice, Mondo Washington column of that same day, Sybil Edmonds said, quote, "There are a lot of activities in the U.S., a lot of money, and these activities involve money laundering, drugs, a support network for terrorism, people in high places, people in the political arena." And we're going to take a look at some of those people in just a couple of minutes. More about the subversion of Operation Green Quest. Research credit on the following article goes to a member of the listening audience. This is from Newsweek, and specifically this is from the MSNBC website. This is from Who's War on Terror? And I will give the full URL later on in the broadcast. This is an update of a story originally published on December 10th of 2003. This appears to have been updated on April 9th. While the U.S. military wages war in Iraq, the FBI and the new Department of Homeland Security are fighting their own fierce battle against each other. And again, I would stress that this is a literally within the intelligence community and law enforcement community. This is a civil war, which in turn is part of a larger war in which the U.S. is facing an attack from without by underground Reich elements and subversion from within by allied domestic elements. Again, from Newsweek, while the U.S. military wages war in Iraq, the FBI and the new Department of Homeland Security are fighting their own fierce battle against each other. The casus belli of this conflict is Operation Green Quest, the high-profile federal task force set up to target the financiers of Al-Qaeda and other international terrorist groups. Ever since Green Quest was created by former U.S. Customs Chief Robert Bonner just after the September 11th terror attacks, Green Quest agents have conducted some of the Bush administration's best publicized and most controversial terrorist finance cases, including a series of raids against the offices of Islamic charities in Washington, in the Washington area last year, that drew strong protests from American Muslim and civil rights groups, and in particular, I would add parenthetically, from elements associated with the Bush administration, because it was those elements that wound up getting targeted to a certain extent by these raids. Continuing. But as the Green Quest team made headlines, its investigations triggered a bitter dispute within the government. Internally, FBI officials have derided Green Quest agents as a bunch of cowboys, unquote, whose actions have undermined more important, long-range FBI investigations into terrorist financing. Green Quest sources in turn accuse the FBI of jealousy. Now that the customs-led Green Quest operation has been folded into the new Homeland Security Department, Newsweek has learned, the FBI and its parent agency, the Justice Department, have demanded that the White House instead give the FBI total control over Green Quest. One senior law enforcement official called the lack of coordination between the FBI and Green Quest, quote, an intolerable situation, unquote, and noted that the Bureau, not Homeland Security, has been formally designated by President Bush as the lead agency, unquote, for terrorism investigations. Again, quoting, you can't have two lead agencies, unquote, conducting terror cases, the official said. The FBI justice move, pushed by Department of Justice Criminal Division Chief Michael Chertoff and Deputy Attorney General Larry Thompson, has enraged Homeland Security officials, however. They accuse the Bureau of sabotaging GreenQuest investigations by failing to turn over critical information to their agents and trying to obscure a decade-long record of lethargy in which FBI offices failed to aggressively pursue terror finance cases. Quote, "They, the FBI, won't share anything with us," unquote, said a Homeland Security official, again quoting, "Then they go to the White House and they accuse us of not sharing. If they can't take it over, they want to kill it," unquote. If nothing else, the battle over GreenQuest illustrates the bureaucratic tensions that still plague the war on terror. The creation of the Homeland Security Department was supposed to put an end to such turf fights. The new department took over a diverse assortment of federal agencies that had various responsibilities for combating terrorism, including the Customs Service, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and the U.S. Border Patrol. But even while the White House was preaching cooperation, the various agencies that were being folded into Homeland Security were squabbling with the FBI, the behemoth in the domestic war on terror. One prime example of the tension is the investigation into PTEC, the Boston-area computer software firm that had millions of dollars in sensitive government contracts with the Air Force, the Energy Department, and, ironically enough, the FBI. In addition, I would note parenthetically, in addition to the Air Force, it also had sensitive software contracts with the Federal Aviation Administration as well. Note that for discussion on side two. Continuing, in what turned into a minor embarrassment for the Bureau, the firm's main investors included Yassin Qadi, a wealthy Saudi businessman whom the Bush administration had formally designated a terrorist financier under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. Al-Qadi has vigorously denied any connection to terrorism. The PTEC case turned into an ugly dispute last year when company whistleblowers told GreenQuest agents about their own suspicions about the firm's owners. Sources close to the case say those same whistleblowers had first approached FBI agents, but the Bureau apparently did little or nothing in response. With backing from the National Security Council, GreenQuest agents then mounted a full-scale investigation that culminated in a raid on the company's office last December. After gaining wind of the GreenQuest probe, the FBI stepped in and unsuccessfully tried to take control of the case. The result, sources say, has been something of a train wreck. Privately, FBI officials say GreenQuest agents botched the probe and jeopardized other more promising inquiries into Al-Qadi. GreenQuest agents dismiss the charges and say the problem is that the Bureau was slow to respond to legitimate allegations that an outside contractor with terrorist ties may have infiltrated government computers. Again, this last sentence. GreenQuest agents dismiss the charges and say the problem is that the Bureau was slow to respond to legitimate allegations that an outside contractor with terrorist ties may have infiltrated government computers. Whatever the truth, there is no dispute that the case has so far produced no charges and indictments against Al-Qadi or anyone else connected with PTEC. The company has denied wrongdoing. By the way, I would add that in our last program, we took a look at the continuing case against Yassin Al-Qadi. Again, the government agencies with whom PTEC had sensitive software contracts included the Air Force, the Federal Aviation Administration, and the FBI. In connection with the FBI's recalcitrant attitude, something that, by the way, predates Robert Mueller, and we're going to talk about FBI collaboration with the Saudi milieu implicated, among other things, in funding Al-Qaeda prior to Mueller's stay on at the Bureau. I want to note something that I took note of in For the Record 310 and also in a number of the programs dealing directly with September 11th, including For the Record 424, and that is that in the summer of 2001, Robert Mueller was made director of the FBI. And Robert Mueller had been a U.S. attorney in charge of a number of different cases, which, had they been properly investigated, and they weren't, would have implicated not only the elder George Bush and some of the Iran-Contra and Iraqgate-related activities, but also would have ultimately gone to the milieu that linked the younger George Bush to the Saudi power elite and the milieu of the BCCI. And in particular, it was the BCCI investigation that was headed up by Robert Mueller and pursued in a, shall we say, less than vigorous and effective fashion that would have not only resulted in the indictment of the elder George Bush and a fuller, more full disclosure of the Iran-Contra and Iraqgate affairs, but also through the investigation into the BCCI milieu, James R. Bath, the milieu of Harkin Energy, Spectrum 7, and Arbusto Energy, it would have gone to the younger George Bush's connections to people like the bin Laden family and Salem bin Laden, and also Khalid bin Mahfouz. And it is those structural economic relationships with both political and commercial components that I believe lie at the foundation of the recalcitrance of the FBI. And I suggested in For the Record 310, again recorded on July 8th of 2001, that the appointment of Robert Mueller to head up the FBI was in all probability directed at blocking the unraveling of some of these investigations. By the way, the number two man, the U.S. attorney who was the number two man in the BCCI investigation, was Rudy Giuliani, who was mayor of New York City on September 11th of 2001. The last attorney general, by the way, under whose supervision both Giuliani and Robert Mueller worked, was William Barr, who was a quote ex-unquote CIA officer who, quote, left, unquote, the agency when a bunch of its operations people were dismissed by Admiral Stansfield Turner, who was appointed by Jimmy Carter to clean out CIA. So on this side, summing up what we've looked at, we took a look at the fact that the Al-Qaeda funding apparatus has not been interdicted. We took a look at FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds' charges that people in high places, people with political connections, and people connected to terrorist financing were involved in the stifling of her attempts at blowing the whistle. We took a look, too, at the war between Homeland Security and the FBI, and we took a look at indications that the FBI has been less than vigorous in pursuing Operation Green Quest, in fact, that they've been sitting on the operation. And last, we took a look at the fact that Yassin Al-Qadi, and it was one of the primary financiers of the P-TECH company, which held sensitive software contracts with, among other institutions, the United States Air Force, and, as we shall see, the Federal Aviation Administration as well. We're going to continue to look into this fifth column, again, conducting what at a domestic level is literally a civil war within the intelligence community and the law enforcement community, and that civil war in turn is part of a broader conflict, a struggle between the U.S. and the underground Reich, a struggle that we are losing, and a struggle that if it is not successfully resolved is going to result in the subversion, the complete subversion of democracy worldwide, and the triumph of darkness. However, we will be talking about that inside too. Alrighty. Now, we've been looking at Operation Green Quest. We've been taking a look at the subversion of the investigation into Al-Qaeda funding sources, and we've been taking a look at the pivotal role of powerful political connections between people within the Bush administration, people within the Republican Party, people within the fossil fuels industry in the U.S., and their business and ideological allies in the Saudi power elite as well. Some of the latter have been involved in helping to finance Al-Qaeda. I have described the interdiction of Operation Green Quest as part of what is at one level a civil war within the intelligence and law enforcement establishments. That in turn is part of a larger struggle, literally a continuation of World War II, in which the underground Reich and its Islamist cadre are attacking the U.S. from the outside at the same time as a fifth column is subverting it from within. This is very much what happened to France in the run-up to World War II. It's why the French capitulated so quickly. Also, I want to stress that one of the things we're going to be looking at in this program concerns not only further inquiries into the P-TECH situation, but note with regard to the curious performance of air defense units on September 11th, note that P-TECH, A company we're going to talk more about was developing software not only for the Air Force, but also for the Federal Aviation Administration as well. More about this Civil War. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who got this from the National Review of May 27th of 2003. Some conservative elements have actually been doing a better job of covering the subversion of Operation Green Quest than many of the so-called progressive media voices. This article is titled Perilous Power Play, FBI versus Homeland Security. It's co-authored by Rita Katz and Josh Devon. Rita Katz, under the pseudonym of Anonymous, wrote a book called Terrorist Hunter that we're going to access again a little later. Rita Katz did much of the groundwork for Operation Green Quest. This article reads, "A war has broken out on American soil, largely below the public radar screen. On May 13, 2003, Attorney General John Ashcroft and Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge signed a, quote, memorandum of agreement, unquote, between the Department of Justice and the Department of Homeland Security that gives the Federal Bureau of Investigation unprecedented unilateral control of all terrorist financing investigations and operations. The agreement raises questions about the need for a Department of Homeland Security if the FBI will be handling all relevant terror investigations. Several seasoned government agents fear for the nation's security should the FBI be tackling the most terrorism cases, as their ineptitude in preventing terrorism has been established time and time again. Yet the memorandum between Ashcroft and Ridge places the FBI in an incredibly powerful position over Homeland Security. According to the memorandum, quote, all appropriate DHS leads relating to money laundering and financial crimes will be checked with the FBI, unquote. If the FBI feels the case is related to terrorist financing and should belong to them, quote, the investigation and operation of the matter shall be led by the FBI, unquote. This usurpation creates a gigantic imbalance of power in criminal investigations, as the FBI now has the power to create or kill any terrorist financing investigation it deems appropriate or inappropriate to investigate. Reviewing, by the way, an item that we looked at in Side 1, we reviewed the fact that FBI Chief Robert Mueller was in charge of the BCCI investigation. That investigation was badly attenuated. Had it been pursued as vigorously as it might have, it not only would have resulted in the indictment of the elder George Bush for Iran-Contra and Iraqgate-related crimes, but it also would have led in the direction of the younger George Bush's connections to the BCCI milieu through people like Salem bin Laden and Khaled bin Mahfouz, both of them, obviously the Salem bin Laden, a member of the bin Laden family, Khalid bin Mahfouz, alleged by many sources to have been involved in terror financing. And bear in mind that, as noted in For the Record 310 and 424, among other programs, Robert Mueller's appointment to head the FBI in the summer of 2001 in many ways heralded the fact that the BCCI milieu would not be pursued in any further investigations. And so far, the FBI has worked in the direction of interdicting terror financing investigations. Those investigations, were they pursued in the way they could be pursued, would lead not only to the Bush administration, the fossil fuels industry, and the Republican Party, as well as their counterparts in Saudi Arabia, but it would lead to the disclosure of connections between the links between the targets of the Operation Green Quest raids and this administration and Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Al-Taqwa, and in the background, the underground Reich. Continuing. Returning once again to this National Review article, this puts the FBI in a position to control too much and is eerily reminiscent of the former Soviet Union's oppressive intelligence agency, the KGB. Like the KGB, the FBI seeks to run itself with no checks and balances, a necessary hallmark of the American system of government and civil rights. The memorandum makes the point that FBI agents assigned to work in conjunction with DHS agents, quote, are provided full and timely access to all data developed in ICE's, Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, money laundering, and financial crimes cases on an ongoing basis, unquote. The reciprocal is not stated in the agreement, continuing the FBI's long-held policy of refusing to share information with other agencies. Amazingly, though, just after 9/11, the FBI admitted it did not have the ability to handle counterterrorism cases. According to a May 2003 General Accounting Office report about interagency information sharing, quote, "The director of the FBI testified in June of 2002 that implementing a more proactive approach to preventing terrorist acts and denying terrorist groups the ability to operate and raise funds require a centralized and robust analytical capability that did not exist in the FBI's counterterrorism division," unquote. Yet, because the FBI is so well-funded and staffed compared to the other agencies, the Bureau can play the PR game better than any other agency. Thus, while strong-arming other agencies and bullying them out of investigations, the FBI maintains a positive face in the eyes of the American public and takes credit for investigations in which they were only tangentially involved. For those who do not fear the FBI will be handling future terrorist financing investigations, let's look at the agency's track record when it comes to protecting the United States from terrorist financing. Now, the next case is the PTEC case about which we spoke in Side 1. This is significant from several different standpoints. First of all, the fact that this software company held sensitive contracts not only with the FBI, but with the U.S. Air Force, the Federal Aviation Administration, and the Department of Defense, also with the White House, raises some very interesting questions about the events of September 11th. We're going to talk about that. Note also the fact that one of the prime financial backers of PTEC is Yassin Al-Qadi, implicated in terrorist financing, someone we spoke about in 461. And note in particular the name of Yaqub Mirza, a member of the board of directors of PTEC. It was Yaqub Mirza who set up the firms that were targeted by the Operation Green Quest raids of March of 2002, yet Mirza was never indicted. Among the elements that were implicated in those raids of 3/20/2002 are elements associated with Grover Norquist and Karl Rove's Islamic Institute. That in turn overlaps not only the GOP's ethnic outreach organization, but also the Bush administration per se. Of the PTEC investigation, we read, "Even after the September 11th attacks, the FBI failed to pursue obvious terrorist financing leads. In a hugely embarrassing moment, the FBI failed to do anything about PTEC Incorporated, a company whose prime investor was a specially designated global terrorist entity, Saudi Yassin Al-Qadi. In desperation, the vice president of sales at PTEC contacted the FBI and pleaded with them to look into the organization, as he saw in the news that Qadi was allegedly connected to funding Al-Qaeda. After repeated meetings with increasingly higher-ranking FBI officials where the employees beseeched the agency to look into the company, the Bureau did nothing, despite knowing that Qadi was a primary financier of PTEC." Note the following. "Furthermore, the FBI was aware that PTEC provided computer software for several government agencies, including the FBI itself, the Federal Aviation Administration, the U.S. Treasury, the Department of Defense, the IRS, and the White House, proving a visible and viable threat to national security." By the way, on Side 1 of the program, we noted that specifically PTEC held contracts with the U.S. Air Force itself. Continuing, "The FBI ignored the repeated requests of concerned employees. Frighteningly, when an employee told the president of PTEC he felt he had to contact the FBI regarding Qadi's involvement in the company, the president allegedly told him not to worry because Yaqub Mirza, who was on the board of directors of the company and was himself a target of a terrorist financing raid in March of 2002, had contacts high within the FBI. After months of the FBI refusing to do anything substantive, it took efforts of U.S. Customs, now a part of Homeland Security, to raid the business in December of 2002 and jumpstart the investigation into the alleged terrorist financial network." Recall that one of the things that we looked at in For the Record 460, interrupting briefly, was the fact that according to the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah, a key al-Qaeda operative captured in Afghanistan in March of 2002, one of the people who was in the employ of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda was the chief of, basically, the head of the Pakistani Air Force. When one considers that allegation, the fact that, according to the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah, the head of the Pakistani Air Force was involved with al-Qaeda, with the fact that a software company financed, in part by an alleged al-Qaeda financier, was developing software for, among other institutions, the FAA, the Air Force, the FBI, and the White House, it raises some very, very interesting questions about the performance of air defense units and the FAA itself on September 11th. And again, the title of this column, of this program, Fifth Column, because it's one of the things that we have going here. More about the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th, 2002. Perhaps the FBI's biggest blunder was in ignoring the enormous alleged terrorist financial network of companies and nonprofit organizations, mostly in Herndon, Virginia, named by investigators as the SAR Network. The FBI had been aware of the SAR network since the early 1990s, when the Bureau investigated alleged terrorist Sami al-Arian, as the investigation revealed that the SAR network was funneling money to al-Arian. The FBI chose to ignore the case for unknown reasons, though some have speculated it was due to the SAR network's close association to wealthy Saudis who funded the network. It was not until Operation Green Quest, a joint task force headed by U.S. Customs, which sought to disrupt terrorist financing, picked up the scent of the SAR network, that a raid even occurred. In March 2002, Green Quest, in a victory for Americans everywhere, raided the SAR network in 15 locations in the largest terrorist financial bust in U.S. history. Skipping down. Now, the FBI is attempting to wrest the SAR network investigation from Green Quest and take all the credit for Green Quest's dedication and hard work. The agreement between Ashcroft and Ridge is a crushing blow to Green Quest, as it effectively dissolves the outstanding task force. According to the memorandum, quote, "The Secretary of Homeland Security agrees that no later than June 30, 2003, Operation Green Quest will no longer exist as a program name." Green Quest, the most successful anti-terrorist financing task squad in the history of the United States, is being disbanded because of the FBI's lust for power and glory. At a time when al-Qaeda is resurging, the more agencies we have sharing information and investigating terrorism, the better off this nation will be. Given the FBI's track record, the Bureau should be punished, not rewarded, for unjustifiably bullying a new department into giving it more power, especially after FBI Director Robert Mueller admitted the Bureau does not have the analytical capability to provide effective counterterrorism. And I would suggest that Mueller, who was less than vigorous in his pursuit of operation of the BCCI investigation, was basically appointed for political reasons, because he could be counted upon to interdict the investigations into the terrorist financing conduits, because those would ultimately overlap the structural economic relationships between the GOP, the Bush administration, and the Saudi power elite, many of whom are implicated in the financing of terrorism. Now, note that one of the directors of PTEC, the Yassin al-Qaeda finance company that we were just talking about, was Yaqub Mirza, who set up the various fronts in the SAR network. We're going to review now a short section from an article called Charity Cases. This is authored by Dave Armstrong. It's called, the article specifically, Charity Cases: Why Has the Bush Administration Failed to Stop Saudi Funding of Terrorism? It's by David Armstrong from the March 2004 issue of Harper's Magazine. We've talked about this in past broadcasts. Of Yaqub Mirza and his sacrosanct status. And the connections do not end there. One of the Muslim activists who met with O'Neill, that's former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, was Talat Otman, a longtime friend and former business associate of President Bush. The two served together on the board of the Texas-based oil company Harkin Energy starting in the late 1980s and have remained close ever since. Otman sat on Harkin's board as the representative of Abdullah Taha Baksh, a Saudi business magnate, and a close associate of suspected terrorist financier Khalid bin Mahfouz. Baksh now heads an oil company that is a subsidiary of Halliburton, the energy giant formerly run by Vice President Dick Cheney. In addition to his work at the Islamic Institute, Again, that headed up by Grover Norquist and greatly aided by Karl Rove, Ottman serves on the board of Amana Mutual Funds Trust, an Islamic investment group that had close ties to raided entities and yet was not itself targeted. At the time of the Green Quest raids in March of 2002, at least four figures from the targeted groups were affiliated with Amana, including M. Yaqub Mirza, the individual who set up the U.S. branch of the Muslim World League, the fundraising arm of the U.S. branch of IIRO, and many of the other raided organizations. Despite Mirza's presence on the board, and despite the fact that large sums of money from the suspect groups have moved through Amana, Green Quest agents chose not to raid the firm. But somebody who did receive heat from the authorities were the people who had originally broken the Operation Green Quest raids, including Rita Katz, the co-author of that National Review article that I just read. Reviewing from Terrorist Hunter by Rita Katz, the CIA was investigating me and the SAR investigators from Green Quest and Customs. The CIA and the FBI investigated everyone who had anything to do with the SAR investigation. White vans and SUVs with dark windows appeared near all the homes of the SAR investigators. All agents, some of whom were very experienced with surveillance, knew they were being followed. So was I. I felt that I was being followed everywhere and watched at home, in the supermarket, on the way to work, and for what? The customs agents were questioned. So were their supervisors. So was the U.S. attorney on the SAR case. One of the questions they were all asked was whether they'd leaked material to me. They all kept saying that this was the most preposterous idea. They all said that before I came, none of them had the slightest clue about SAR and 555. They said that there was nothing of value they could give me that I didn't have already. That it was I who gave them the material, not the other way around. None of the investigated parties has the slightest clue as to the real reason they were being investigated, unquote. Risking criticism for being unfoundly paranoid, I must convey my theory about the investigation and the CIA's involvement in it. I don't know for certain what's the deal between the CIA investigating the SAR investigators, but it sure feels as if someone up in that agency doesn't like the idea that the Saudi Arabian boat is rocked. The raids on 555 Grove Street had already taken place. The CIA couldn't change that. But investigating and giving the people behind the raids a hard time is a most efficient way of making sure the SAR investigation stops there. Which, come to think of it, may be the reason the government looks so unfavorably on the lawsuit filed by 9/11 victims' families against several Saudi entities and individuals, accusing them of funding terrorism and seeking damages. Unquote. And more now about this Wahhabi lobby fifth column, basically, in the United States. First of all, note that M. Yaqub Mirza was described by, in that passage we read, as having high contacts within the FBI. That's consistent with the charges that were voiced by Sybil Edmonds with regard to the reasons for her being muzzled, and also for the apparent interdiction of Operation Green Quest and the civil war which is currently taking place. We're going to turn now to the book House of Bush, House of Saud, by Craig Unger, a newly released and very good book detailing the structural economic relationships between the Bush administration, the petroleum industry, and the Saudi power elite, and the latter have been involved in the financing of al-Qaeda. One of the things we're going to talk about here is the relationship between Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador to the United States and someone who's very, very close to both George's Bush, and former FBI Director Louis Freeh. And specifically, we're going to take a look at the establishment of a backdoor channel between Prince Bandar and Louis Freeh that helped to subvert the Clinton administration's investigation into Saudi financing of al-Qaeda. After the Khobar Towers bombing in 1996, Clinton's National Security Advisor Sandy Berger met with Prince Bandar to press for better Saudi cooperation with the FBI. But the Saudis still refused to allow the FBI access to the suspects or relevant materials and tried to blame Iran for the bombing. Berger got nowhere. According to Benjamin and Simon, Bandar's unending evasions were so frustrating that Berger described them as Groundhog Day rituals, a reference to the Bill Murray movie in which one day repeats itself endlessly. At the same time Prince Bandara was stalling Berger, however, he had secretly established a back channel to FBI Director Louis Free. A 1993 Clinton appointee, Free had never enjoyed a good relationship with the White House, partly because of the Bureau's disastrous failure in counterterrorism. According to Benjamin and Simon, Bandar eagerly exploited Free's well-known antipathy toward Clinton to, quote, undercut U.S. efforts to pursue the investigation, unquote. Notwithstanding Berger's repeated efforts to get Saudi help, Bandar told Free again and again that the White House had absolutely no interest in the investigation whatsoever. But President Clinton kept after the Saudis. When he met with Saudi Crown Prince Abdullah in 1998, Clinton warned Abdullah that Saudi-American relations would suffer if the Saudis did not cooperate on the Khobar Towers investigation. Nevertheless, Bandar continued to tell Free that he was the only one in Washington who cared about the Americans who had died in Khobar Towers. In response, Free did something highly irregular. He reached out to former President Bush, knowing full well how Bush was revered by the Saudis, and asked Bush to be his secret emissary to get the Saudis to cooperate with the investigation. Later, Bandar invited Free to his estate in Northern Virginia and told him the FBI would be allowed to watch through a one-way mirror while Saudis interrogated the subjects. According to Elsa Walsh of The New Yorker, Free credited this sudden breakthrough not to the Clinton administration's efforts, but to former President George H.W. Bush. Whether it was Bush's phone call or pressure from Clinton that actually triggered the Saudi cooperation is not entirely clear. But one thing was certain: the House of Saud preferred Bush, not Clinton, in part because the Democratic administration was violating the unwritten rule about Saudi-American relations. Don't ask any questions about what really goes on in Saudi Arabia. And then Craig Unger goes on to write about some of the BCCI links to the Saudi milieu that was funding al-Qaeda. And still later, Craig Unger briefly encapsulates the formation of the Islamic Institute and the links between the GOP and the Muslim milieu that was targeted in Operation Green Quest. By the way, there's good discussion in this book of how a great many of the Muslim elements that have risen to the fore in the American Muslim community are not in any way representative of worldwide Muslims, but rather are the sort of reactionaries from the Islamic world that the Bush administration, basically the counterparts to the Bush administration. They are altogether reactionary and not representative. Nevertheless, with Norquist working behind the scenes, Bush aggressively pursued the Islamists in hope of winning their endorsements. In appearances on TV, Bush and fellow campaign staffers referred not just to churches and synagogues as places of worship, but to mosques as well. And talking about the Sami al-Aryan relationship, but Aryan had unusual credentials for a Bush supporter. Since 1995, as the founder and chairman of the board of World and Islam Enterprise, or WISE, a Muslim think tank, al-Aryan had been under investigation by the FBI for his associations with Islamic Jihad, the Palestinian terrorist group. And this goes on to describe not only Sami al-Aryan, but the links between the Islamic Institute and the targets of the Operation Green Quest raids. However, ultimately, some of the key documentation was destroyed of the Sami al-Aryan case was destroyed. In December of 2003, clerks at a federal courthouse in Tampa accidentally destroyed search warrants in the al-Aryan case. The documents contained affidavits from federal agents that supported 1995 searches of al-Aryan's home and offices and were among thousands of documents shredded sometime between 1998 and 2002. As this book went to press, there were serious questions as to whether the destruction of the documents might affect his prosecution. And again, talking more about the GOP Islamist links. When the convention ended on August 3rd, after George W. Bush had formally been nominated for president, between his family's extended personal and financial ties to the House of Saud and his campaign's ties to Islamists, it could be said that he was truly the Arabian candidate. And there will be more documentation presented on this connection in the description for the Record program number 462. This, however, concludes side two of For the Record 462, fifth column, part three, The Subversion of Operation Green Quest. This is being recorded on May 30th of 2004. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.